If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Hi, this is Riley Fessler, producer for the DSR Network. Today's episode, From the Silo, is a Words Matter, where Norm and Kavita talk about the efforts in the South to turn back the clock on a myriad of issues. We hope you enjoy.
This is Words Matter with Norm Ornstein.
We've got the votes and screw the rest of you.
And Dr. Kavita Patel.
These might be some of the smaller moments, you know, with all the bombshells didn't catch people's eyes.
Hello and welcome to Words Matter from the DSR Network. Each week, Norm Ornstein and I will talk about the issues facing our country as we enter into another election cycle and discuss what our leaders are saying and doing about them or not saying or doing about them. All right, Norm, today we, as usual, have a treasure trove of topics to discuss in planning today. Hope that we can tackle for the broader conversation. Would love to tackle your perspective on what feels like, I will say, an almost hourly assault on democracy. And whether you're a registered Republican, Democrat, independent, it should be of great concern. So maybe we can dive into some of what is emerging from the South. And I think in an email that Norm sent, he put it better than I could. The Confederacy is winning and we're implementing, you know, as we knew all along, two Americas, but with the kinds of laws that give very little hope to getting to like a unified America that I certainly remember both Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama talking about. And then in our members only section, we will carry that theme of the Confederacy is winning and hope that our members can join us for a discussion of the Walgreens abortion pill, I will call it disaster, and that's not even a word that's appropriate enough, as well as reactions from legislators and governors, including Governor Gavin Newsom from California, who was very bold in what he said, which is basically, Walgreens, stay out of California, if this is what you're going to do. So, Norm, I hope you had a good week. I hope you had your Wheaties, because we are going to go off to the races with lots to talk about. Where should we start? Where in the South would you like to begin? And take your pick: media, voting, drag shows.
So, what I want to do first, Kavita, is just to step back and look at this more broadly. At the time of the founding, we had a pitched battle between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists wanted an exceptionally weak central government and to give basically all the power to the individual states. They lost. The Constitution created a pretty strong central government. It was a central government that had been basically crafted by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. And while Thomas Jefferson didn't particularly like it, he wanted an agrarian society with the power, you know, devolving to the noble farmers. But of course, when Jefferson became president, the hallmark of his presidency was the Louisiana Purchase, which was one of the strongest exercises of power that the federal government has done. But the reality is the Anti-Federalists are winning. They never went away. The conservative movement, which has become a radical movement, is trying to create far more power in states. And that is because they want the South, which tried to keep that power to keep their slavery, to prevail again. And they are prevailing again. And what we're seeing is that the South, which lost again in the Civil War, came back, obviously, in the Reconstruction era. We could talk a lot about history and about how the 1876 election, which was a lot like the 2000 election, made all the difference. It resulted in a compromise that took the federal troops out of the South, and, you know, Black people moved close to enslavement again. But even after the Civil Rights Movement, now they're back. And what's so distressing about it, I would say, is on two fronts. The first is we're getting these draconian laws, and we need to talk about some of these laws that are moving forward, some of which are already enacted. Others have been proposed and very likely will be enacted, some of them unconstitutional, although with this Supreme Court, which is already a victory for the anti-federalists and for the segregationists, we don't know what they'll do. But the other part of it that I really want to emphasize is that in that victory, the people of the South are the losers. If you look at every indicator of what good governance should mean, which should be low child mortality rates, strong education, a social contract that works for people, they're at the absolute bottom. These Southern states may have won, but boy, what a Pyrrhic victory. But the second thing that I want to just raise, and we can talk about it more, is, and it gets to the Walgreens issue in another way, we have one district court judge in Amarillo, Texas, who is going to try to impose his radical social values on the entire country by banning the use of the anti-abortion pill nationwide. So it's not about states' rights anymore. It's also about, we want states' rights, but we want to impose them on all the other states as well. And we're headed towards a confrontation that may be secession before we know it.
There is so much to unpack there. And let me actually put that in light of the context that we also had CPAC going on kind of during this time period. And so it was interesting. I actually have a very close, very senior Washington Post journalist whom you and I both know very well personally, who actually said this was one of the first years that he declined going to CPAC because it was just too, like, there wasn't even any productive way to write a narrative or to write about what the narrative was, that it was just so disgusting. And normally, like any online outlet would say, you know, they've got their fact checkers at work. But essentially, I think Linda Q from the New York Times, basically, there was so many PolitiFact fact-checking errors that were just found in the statements that were made. But here's where I thought it intersects with exactly what you're saying, that they keep talking, various speakers, you know, everything from Trump to Lake to others, talking about that the Department of Justice is calling parents worried about their children's educations because of all the, you know, like sexual education around LGBTQ communities, that they're also concerned about the rise in opioid deaths being linked to kind of this dramatic rise in crime. We can normalize using state power to kind of have violence against criminals. And it's just feeding into this like narrative that, to your point, honestly, it's martial law. It's what the narrative was around the United States Civil War. And it's as if there's like this, okay, you know, crime is on the upswing. Oh, look, who's committing these crimes? It's these minorities that we've given all these rights to and all these like sexual predators. And I mean, it is incredible to the extent of fear mongering to get to your point and then double down. We talk a lot, you and I, about the media. I mean, I don't know if we're going to get a chance to talk about Tucker Carlson. We can save that for so many other times and hours. But like, then you take what's on, not even Fox News, take any level of like media, they'll amplify that. And then they'll talk about like, you know, the Dominion voting systems. And they'll, I mean, just on and on and on. Nicole Wallace on MSNBC, you know, she keeps, you know, others reference the big lie. But like, it gets to the point where I don't think people understand lies, facts to this. And still not talking, like, you know, how many times did I watch the hearings this week and heard nothing about January 6th? So here we have like these narratives, right? And you're right, like it's just dividing the country. But, you know, do we have like any
return to, on media or otherwise, return to literally like hours of violent footage, you know, whether or not like people have been held accountable for this. It gets to the point where you, as somebody who is enjoying, like you, residence in a pretty blue state, I've kind of cocooned myself in many ways with people who vote probably similar to myself around me, can't help but think, yeah, I made the right decision. Like, I got out of the South, I did this. And so you're right, who's left to suffer? It's everyone in these regions and states. So let me then put to you, I've thought about this, and our incredible producer has also asked us to discuss, like, so then what? What is it? Is it that liberal states like Maryland or purple states create safe havens for people, tax incentives to come here if you're sick of the fear-mongering? What are some of the solutions if we can't rely on our elected leaders to help us fix these problems?
You know, we're facing, I think, some, I wouldn't say quite unprecedented, but extraordinary challenges right now. What do we do knowing that the structural anomalies of our political system mean that the will of a majority can be thwarted over and over again? The Senate is very likely to go Republican in 2024, no matter what happens, just because there are basically only 11 Republican seats up, and they're all from pretty firmly red states. You know, the most competitive Republican seat might be in Florida, which has gone from purple to red. And Rick Scott is terrible, but so is Marco Rubio, and he got reelected handily. And then there are all these vulnerable Democratic seats, West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana among them. So holding the Senate is going to be extremely difficult. You can't rely on that, even if we see a backlash against Republican extremism. And then we get to another reality, which is, what if we don't have safe havens anymore because the judges, the radical judges in the country, where we have a system where any individual district judge can basically issue nationwide injunctions? What if California isn't safe anymore? What if we get judges who basically ban abortion nationwide, no matter what states want to do? And you haven't got the remedy at the federal government because the system has thwarted that from happening, the Senate especially, making it almost impossible. And, you know, you start to wonder whether we can hold together as a union under those circumstances. And what I see is, and, you know, gets us back in part to the press corps, which seems utterly immune from either understanding or reporting on the grim realities that we're dealing with here, with the gravity that's needed. It's still all both sides are treating it as normal. You know, we may head for a national divorce of some sort. And I don't know how all of that plays out. Now, you know, it may be that that's much too grim and that we'll recover from this and that the backlash will be serious and strong enough. And it may be that the Republicans, because of what they're doing in the House and in the states, are going to overreach so much that moderate individuals, the college-educated voters in suburbs and elsewhere, will rebel against it. But the tribal instinct is so strong. And I'll raise one other thing that we will have to discuss at a separate point. No Labels, a group which purports to be nonpartisan, but which basically is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party, has raised $50 million or more to put a third-party candidate on the ballot for president in 2024. They are now on the ballot in Arizona, one of the swing states. If they succeed, it would likely elect Trump or another Republican to the presidency, even if that's not what the majority of voters want. And we could be in an even worse place looking forward. It's a possibility strong enough that we have to be very concerned.
Yeah, it's not just that. In addition to that, I'm smiling because maybe it caught your eye. It was that, I forget, it was the Times or the Post or Atlantic. Anyway, Jim Jordan, just something to keep an eye on is that we're also seeing
these same leaders and reporters of the big lie that have now, they're in leadership on committees in the House, and they are putting in what is a typical kind of scenario where every 2 years, like the new Congress and the new leadership in the committees put in budget requests for their committees. I was a staff director for Kennedy under the HELP committee. This was an exercise that we were very familiar with, where we would try to identify costs. The committee kind of divides the costs and in the House, primarily owned by the party in majority, in this case, the Republicans. But we would make requests for things like field hearings. You know, how many field hearings are we going to do? What are we going to do on the ground to help advance the work of the committee and bring it to the people? Well, this was like a record year, apparently. Jordan put in like a request of at least $250,000, primarily for field hearings. Just to be clear, like in previous years, both Republican and Democratic Congresses, that amount is usually anywhere from like a fourth to a fifth of that. And it's because, although you and I have joked about how they don't seem to be working as much as they should be working, which I agree with, Congress has a pretty packed like schedule when they're in session. They are in session and there's usually like always a series of hearings. When they're on recess, it's always a time-honored tradition for the members to use that as a time to press the flesh and get campaign fundraising. And committees usually don't do work during those breaks and periods. Well, this is like a whole new ballgame. And honestly, Norm, that time, like from what you were saying about like the campaign donations to even watching Jordan's quest for, which will get honored. I mean, most of what I thought was shame on Democrats for like not even a learning. I was thinking back to 2008 and thinking back to how many times in 2009 did I regret that, you know, yeah, we did the Affordable Care Act. That was a very big deal, a BFD, as Joe Biden would say. But I really regret, Norm, look at all the things we squandered and lost opportunity to act. I can't help but think whether it's abortion or maybe we can talk about Tennessee and Florida and some of the drag laws, or maybe DeSantis doing what I think is the inching towards announcing. Could any of this have been averted? I don't know. But if we couldn't learn it in 08, if I couldn't learn, you know, can't learn it in 22, I worry that the narrative of 22 was that, you know, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. There wasn't this red tide that we saw come in, this red wave that came in. That wasn't the lesson. The lesson was, wow, doesn't matter whether the red wave did come in or not. You don't take a pillow to a knife fight. And that's what we've been doing. Your thoughts?
You're absolutely right. It's also, take it back and you look at the accidents of history. The Supreme Court has turned out the way that it has because of little things happening and Republicans taking advantage by playing hardball. And Democrats have been reluctant to do so. And it's try to play by the rules when the other side doesn't play by the rules. And there'll be some reckoning ahead on this front. But, you know, it's also when you have close margins like we have, we're now seeing in the Senate, Joe Manchin basically just killed several confirmations, including Gigi Sohn for the FCC. The FCC is now basically unable to act on almost anything in a place where we have enormous priorities and responsibilities. And Manchin's blocking that. He is going to block others. And, you know, when you have these margins, the ability to counter the racist moves by the Supreme Court, voting rights, Shelby County, Brnovich, and others, block because you couldn't get enough senators to change the rules on the filibuster. When you have a court that's tilted the way it is, we're in bad shape as a consequence. And a part of it is the challenge that Democrats have. If you've got a huge margin, you can lose some people on the left side of your party, on the right side of your party. When you have these narrow margins, you can't lose anybody. In a lot of ways, in 2009, it was miraculous that we got the Affordable Care Act. And it was partly just as a consequence the mastery of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid at being able to pull their troops together. But it also meant in the process of doing it that we got a diluted Affordable Care Act and didn't get the things that would have made such a dramatic difference. And we're now in a worse place as a consequence. And I don't see in the foreseeable future things changing enough where you have a Congress that could assert itself in ways that are necessary to deal, for example, basically having a national law that codifies Roe v. Wade. You can't do that unless you've got enough Democrats in the Senate to change the filibuster rule and then to hold together to make it happen. And for that, you probably need 55 or 56 Democrats in the Senate. And right now, it would be an enormous triumph if they were able to hold on to 49 or 50. So we're not in a place where we can undo a lot of what's been done. One question ahead, of course, is whether Republicans, under the weakest and most feckless leader I have ever seen, Kevin McCarthy, send us over the cliff on the debt ceiling, and then whether the backlash that comes from the turmoil that ensues damages Republicans. And it's not at all clear to me that it will, because Fox, whatever happens in this trial, and they're clearly caught dead to rights in the Dominion trial, they continue to lie. Tucker Carlson continuing to show that they are willing to broadcast lies. They're still going to have their voters thinking, no matter what happens, we'll blame Biden. So what we can do here, I will say that everybody listening should pay attention to the Wisconsin Supreme Court race that will be resolved in another 3 weeks. And democracy is on the ballot there. If we cannot win over the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, which has been an entirely radical arm of the Republican Party, which will implement draconian voting rules, which will limit the power of a Democratic governor and give it to gerrymandered state legislature, then we're in even worse shape than the dire things I've been saying and you've been saying.
Yeah, it's no, I'm glad you brought up trying to tie this back to what we've talked about at state levels and with Manchin, who I'm still kind of waiting for him to either officially join like the Republican Party or to keep his incredible power, which I guess he probably will in this day and age where Senate is hanging on every, you know, word that he states, along with Kristen Sinema. I can't help but also want to remind people about the other action that happened. It was actually a week ago, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it in the previous pod around Bill Lee, the Tennessee Republican governor, who signed a law into place signed a bill that restricts public performances, any performance with topless dancers, go-go dancers, exotic dancers, strippers, male or female impersonators who provide entertainment that appeals to a prurient interest or similar entertainers, which has now been kind of dubbed like the, you know, the drag show law. But what was hypocrisy in reporting that has come out since the signing of the law was that he had images of him in high school in the 70s wearing a dress and basically then had his own spokesperson, the governor's spokesperson, saying that it was a lighthearted school tradition conflated with obscene sexualized entertainment. Lee's spokesperson's words, not mine. And I think that it's just an incredible, like it's just another reminder to your point about court decisions as well as kind of what's happening in many state halls around the country. This is actually what's happened for most of not just the 21st century, most of the 20th century, right? This is a very conservative led states which have legislation that anything from banning women wearing skirts, you know, above their knees, all the way to even when like the right to marriage, especially for same-sex persons, kind of became like in the 21st century, a much more like state supported like law. The conservative states then kind of put into place, you know, an outlaw on performing, quote, womenless weddings. So things like these are very, I think that conservative organizations that are local, and I'm not calling out every Rotary Club or every Lion Club or every Chamber of Commerce, but I think it's very clear that all things are local, as we know in DC, and that these are like communities where there's been a systematic, not just for years, but for decades, like threat. Okay, we're coming into our final minutes on our broader conversation before we get into that very important Walgreens, California state assault conversation. So much of a theme to this is purveying and preying on what I would say for any parent is this fear, like, did something happen out of my control that is going to affect or hurt my child? And that is a theme now somehow that I do feel like, Norm, suggest to me, if you will, whether it's Tennessee and this drag show law, or what I just described as like literally a century of positioning themselves against certain suggestive sexual behaviors, as they put it. Now it does seem like it's shifted to fear tactics about your children. Am I right? Am I wrong? Does that tell us something about the playbook that's being used for the big lie? What are your thoughts?
Well, there are a couple of elements here. We've always been reluctant in the past to use the analogies to Germany. But the fact is, the analogies apply now, and it's a little frightening. It was finding scapegoats in populations that could arouse the worst instincts in a population, the fear, and use it and exploit it to assume power and to command power. But it also resulted in deaths, murders, ultimately a genocide. And remember, the Nazis didn't just go after Jews. They went after gypsies. They went after homosexuals. And I think this war on the trans community, this attempt to avoid an appeal to prurient interest, although it appears now that prurient interest might have been Bill Lee, Governor Lee's, among others, and of course the projection that we see here. But it starts with those communities and then it moves to others. And this is, I think this is a strategy. We're not just going to use race. We're not just going to go after Asians and Blacks. We are going to go after the trans community, the LGBT community, and the way to frame it is the danger to your children, the grooming term. And it's going to result in a lot of deaths, a lot of violence, but it's frightening because it doesn't stop there. You move on to other populations. And, I would just as a final note, speaking of Tennessee, and Tennessee is not the worst, and what we see in some of these other states, Mississippi, where Governor Tate Reeves basically steals federal funds from an important program for children to buy $10,000 worth of a children's book that his wife did, basically putting money in her pocket. Where in Mississippi, Brett Favre and the former governor stole a lot of federal money aimed at poor people for their own purposes. In Tennessee, which we can remember was where the Scopes trial occurred, where they tried to basically ban the study of evolution. And we're seeing that emerge in other states again now. But, where it used to be a Republican Party, where you had people like Bill Brock and Bob Corker, and before he became a full MAGA person, Lamar Alexander, now it's the party of Lee and Marsha Blackburn and Desjardins and others who have just gone off the deep end of the spectrum. And that's replicated in so many other states. And we're not going back, at least not for a substantial period of time. So brace yourselves, listeners. We've got some rocky roads ahead in the next couple of years, at least.
Yeah, I think it's a good word of warning. Thank you for, by the way, you're right. It's not, Tennessee is not the worst. And you and I both knew, I've worked with back then, Senator Bill Frist, and he was like emblematic of like the Tennessee Republican, right? I mean, what I would give to have those conversations back in a heartbeat any day now. And so you're right. So in closing, let's probably leave like on at least somewhat of an, I don't know about optimism in the short term, but I do have optimism that like knowledge and information is power. And just like it is with COVID, just like it is with anything, hopefully we are bringing some level of this knowledge and information. Too much in the media, including the networks you and I kind of are on and we watch a lot, just kind of is now all about like the salaciousness of the media and the clicks. And what we're hoping to do here in the pod is actually offer, even with our opinions overlaying, just some of the things that I don't even know. If you're sitting in a suburb in Illinois, you have no idea that these are happening in your backyard, or that they might be happening in your neighbor's backyard. And I think it's good to bring these conversations up. So with that, I want to thank all our incredible listeners for joining us. And please, please, please rate, review, subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast player. We're on all of them. And if you can, think about becoming a member where you can join our discussion next. We're going to talk about Walgreens and just the implications of a judge in Texas, as Norm mentioned, literally taking back an authorization for decades of a safe and effective drug. And then you'll get access to these bonus conversations across all of our pod platform. So thank you so much. Words Matter is a production of the DSR Network. I want to thank our incredible producer, Grant Haber, and our executive producer, Chris Cotmore. And our next episode will be in your pod feeds on March 16th. See you then. Welcome to our members-only section for Words Matter, and really excited to actually tackle what has become, honestly, an evolving conversation, Norm, about mifepristone, which is one part of a two-drug regimen used for medication abortion. More than 52% of all abortions in the United States are done with this two-drug prescribed regimen. And have been for years. I'm a prescriber. And just to give people context, that ever since the drug was approved for this indication in the 2000s, we have been under what's called a REMS. It's a evaluation and monitoring of safety. And the registry evaluation monitoring, REMS, regimen for this drug. It's much like another drug that I used in the past, prescribed in the past, called Accutane. It's basically a system for any drug that they want to make sure that there are its risk evaluation and mitigation strategies. It's a way to make sure that for any of these drugs where we want to ensure that there are conversations happening with the person, the patient, that we follow at least a protocol for consent, and that we actually, as me as a physician, logs in and registers that I had a prescription for this so that we can track any safety issues. It's generally reserved for drugs in which there is a concern that there could be some safety flags and that we want to monitor those safety flags. Or number two, that the public has a responsibility for receiving knowledge and information that normally might not occur if you did not have this process in place. The reason I say all that is because to prescribe mifepristone, you cannot just, you know, write a prescription and send it in the mail. It's an incredibly complex process. And until recently, the Biden administration made this easier to access by allowing for telehealth, for allowing for retail pharmacies like Walgreens and CVS and Rite Aid to distribute this at the point of retail. It wasn't as easy to get in retail sites before, but that's because we've had decades of safety information and that process I outlined, REMS, has worked. So this is now, in light of the fact that we have a Texas judge for literally I actually don't know when this is going to happen. I thought it would happen 2 weeks ago. For weeks, we've been expecting a ruling and on a Trump-appointed, a Texas-based, as you mentioned in our conversation broader, Texas-based Trump appointee who is going to decide on a lawsuit brought about by an anti-abortion organization called the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. And the group is specifically seeking an injunction to prevent the distribution of one of the two-part drugs, mifepristone, again, the one that I mentioned that has been around for decades. And this ruling, which will likely pull mifepristone from the market, would actually then send legally throughout the entire country a reversal, quote unquote, of this FDA decision and making it essentially, it's not illegal. It would bring up to legality whether I could then prescribe it for a medication abortion. Also a fun fact, the drug is actually also has a second indication for a much more rare syndrome called Cushing's syndrome. It's an endocrine disorder syndrome. And the reason I bring up Cushing's syndrome is because many of us were joking about whether or not we should all just, you know, be prescribing this for people with Cushing's syndrome, which, again, this is a joke, not something I would encourage people to do. But it's something that Eunice Kennedy had this disease, and so Cushing's syndrome. So I was joking with old colleagues of mine that worked for Ted Kennedy, like somehow the Kennedys will come to the rescue when you need them to, because maybe we'll all use this as a drug. And then just to catch listeners up to speed, if you haven't been paying attention, Walgreens then, of course, with a very like kind of, you know, legal kind of general statement, said that they were not going to distribute the abortion medication abortion in states where the attorneys general have threatened legal action. And that is including in states where it still remains legal. So 21 Republican-controlled states where the chain would not distribute the drug, including in states where it is still legal. That resulted in California's Governor Gavin Newsom saying that the state, quote unquote, won't be doing business, quote, close quote, with Walgreens, and that, unquote, under quote, all relationships between Walgreens and the state were under review, and that they would not renew Walgreens' $54 million contract to fulfill inmates' prescriptions. Then Walgreens did what any corporate entity with publicly traded stock would do and said, wait a minute, no. We're going to do it wherever it's legally permissible to do so. Meanwhile, in the like very small, dramatic world of healthcare, all of us are waiting to see what CVS is doing. They've been silent. CVS is another retail prescription outlet that is absolutely going to be caught in this. It is caught in this crossfire, but has been very has not been vocal. Adding even more political intrigue to this is that the two CEOs, Walgreens and CVS, are women. And it's just notable that the CEO of Walgreens, Roz Brewer, who I don't know, I've never spoken to, is literally one of two Black female CEOs in the Fortune 500 company. So it's one of these like, I mean, so I had to do media last week. I was on MSNBC and we were going to talk about Walgreens. And I said to the producer, I'm like, I really don't, like, I have such mixed feelings about trashing an organization where we finally have like a Black female CEO. We have like female leadership. She hired a majority female executive team. And I was like, man, nothing gives me more pause. All right. That was a lot of me talking to give listeners some context. Norm, your thoughts, your reactions, as well as your prediction of like, what are states like Maryland, where it is legal, and we're not fighting it, like what are states around these states going to have to do to protect people from all of this?
That was a lot of good talking, really important and interesting. I will say this with limited sympathy for Walgreens. When Citizens United was adopted by the Supreme Court, I did a program where the narrator asked me, well, isn't the businesses going to be thrilled with this because now they can contribute to campaigns? And I said, no, they're not. Because they're going to get caught in a crossfire. Now, because they can use corporate funds for political purposes in a way they couldn't before, you're going to have the Republican Party going to them and threatening them if they give any money to Democrats. And they're going to be shaken down and told, hey, you've got this priority, you want this regulation, you're going to have to pay for it. And companies are caught in the crosshairs in so many ways. And this was Walgreens, which I am sure had no desire to be caught in the middle with this, but which got weak and caved when 21 Republican attorneys general threatened them, and now are realizing what happens when you're in the middle and you give in to one side and you're going to face significant repercussions on the other. And I'm sure that the CVS leadership is almost literally quaking in its collective boots that they're going to be next to be caught in the crosshairs. And of course, you also have a Republican Party that was thrilled to have the corporations involved like this and which have been staunchly supportive of free speech for companies, except when they speak in ways they don't like. And of course, what we've seen now is, just to move to another topic for a moment, Ron DeSantis has taken over governance for Disney World because he didn't like what Disney was doing on the LGBTQ front and replaced it with a board that includes nutcases and radicals. And who knows what they'll do? Of course, it'll be damaging to the state. What Walgreens has done is going to be damaging to Walgreens. But what we also know more broadly is that the repercussions here, if we get this ruling by perhaps the most radical judge in the country, although obviously Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas would give him a run for his money. One judge only in Amarillo targeted for this because the group that you mentioned knows what it wants. If you have a nationwide injunction here, it's basically moving to try to ban abortion nationally. And it's one of many steps that we can expect going forward if this happens. And I don't know what states do. And the idea that you're going to take on and ban a drug which has been approved by the FDA for its safety and efficacy, which has, as you said, been used for a very long time, is chilling. We don't know what other drugs come. What happens when you get more renegade judges basically substituting their own ideological fervor for the reality of what laws and conventions ought to be? And it's not a good thing. And Walgreens is going to suffer, but the fact is a whole lot more people will suffer more than Walgreens.
Exactly. So that's where I keep coming back to. So I'll tell you maybe it will help listeners to hear what I've been doing behind the scenes. There's like a little network of us who are trying to kind of plan, because I should say, by the way, that we will see effects of this if this judge in Amarillo gets his way, which we fully expect and are planning for, then even in a state that's very protected, like the state of Maryland, or in states where there have been laws, state laws on the book, like Vermont affirming, or Michigan affirming a woman's right in reproductive justice, that we need a plan so that if I don't have this ability to prescribe this medication because the FDA's like label has been yanked and can't prescribe it, you know, do I use the Eunice Kennedy loophole or what do I do? We're all going to use the second drug. There's been a couple of articles just making it very clear that it's safe to have a medication abortion with just the one drug. Recently, we used the two drugs, Norms, because that first drug, mifepristone, the one that's at debate here, helps to like get the woman's uterus ready. The second drug, misoprostol, is actually what like causes the uterine to contract and expel any contents of the uterus. Without getting too graphic, using just that second drug alone creates a longer kind of bleeding time, recovery time, and is more painful for the woman. So I think that I can't help but feel, I'm going to kind of close and ask you a question, because this is going to sound like I'm whining, but I'm really not. I'm trying to dissociate myself from this. Nor it feels like that, again, that Kansas, you know, wave where we fought the red wave and we got these victories and women came out and voted. I don't know if I'm feeling like that same level of energy. And you very eloquently made this comment about Walgreens. I have had one too many troubling conversations with very senior Democrats, again, whom you're friends with and I'm friends with, who have said, people are making a really big deal out of Walgreens. It's not that big of a deal, Kavita. Like people, you know, this is just like one pharmacy and blah, blah, blah. And I can't help but think like, no, that's, you're missing the point. Like even if zero people used Walgreens to use it for this drug and that like we could get this, like it is this constant feeling that like you can just pick away at like a person's rights, be it a person of color and their voting or someone who is wearing a certain type of clothing or a woman seeking, you know, health care, and nobody cares. So I need you to close this out by giving us some sense that people care and that you have some hope that there's going to be some energy in 24 about this.
There had better be. We know the energy was there in 2022 after Dobbs. We should note that beyond Walgreens, we had a woman arrested and jailed this week because she had a miscarriage, went to the hospital, told them that she had taken this drug, and she was arrested. There are states where abortion is legal, but where the use of the drug is not. And we also know that there are bills being put in that could basically criminalize women who have abortions. We're looking at places that want to view an abortion as murder, that could bring murder charges against women. We're getting close to a point where The Handmaid's Tale is a reality. And that may happen in at least some states. This goes beyond the issue of one drug and one judge to a much broader assault on fundamental freedoms and rights. And if that doesn't get people excited, moving to try to counter it, then I don't know what would, and we would be doomed if that doesn't take its effect. We're really looking at challenges to the fundamentals that are extraordinary.
Yeah, and I wonder if we can figure out, maybe we can use one of our members or the broader conversation, maybe we can do something with one of the, you and I both know and we can pick Texas. We can start there. I have some colleagues in Texas who'd be more than happy to come on the pod and talk about what they're doing to mobilize, exactly to your point. Like I needed you to put a little bit of sanity into my moment because you can't help but feel like, okay, especially when I had some Democrats literally texting and saying, I mean, is it really that big of a deal? I mean, come on. Like, you know, there's other ways to do this. And there's all these programs. And I said, that's not the point. I mean, the point is that there are literal threats. These are states that are legal. And you can think that that means something. And that there are, that you can just basically throw out a bunch of misinformation and lies and actually get a corporate entity like Walgreens to back down. That's what it means. And there's no, you're right, Citizens United and so many things have deteriorated in this country. But I'm gonna thank our members whom we love, and hopefully we can carry the optimism by bringing in some of those heroes who are working on this on a daily basis.